Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June the 14th, 1996. In the Creekside Room this evening, our speaker is Ingrid Christiansen. Her subject, Telling Our Stories. Let's listen in.
Okay, my name is Ingrid Christiansen, and the title of this session is Telling Your Story, under the rubric of We Are the Stories We Tell. So hi, it's nice to see you all. I'm amazed that you're all here on such a beautiful day and after the wedding, but it's lovely that you've come. For those of you who were here yesterday when we wrote stories, I'm going to review a few things about story and then go on and add some things. And then today we're going to, instead of writing a story, we're going to make a few notes to ourselves and then tell each other stories. So just using storytelling as a verbal art form, which of course is even, it precedes written stories in our history. You know, that's surely the way history was handed along for years and years. And there was a strong urge in people to write them down, and hence people developed language, a written language. But verbal is still time-honored. If any of you have ever played that game that children sometimes learn in school where you whisper a story to your neighbor and then they to their neighbor and then it gets modified and by the time it comes back it's a completely different story. I love that. So I'm going to just briefly say a few things that I said yesterday so that those of you who didn't hear them yesterday can kind of think about them. I want to point out and just raise to your attention that story is so ancient and it embodies things like myth and legend. And it's such an old way for people to order their experience and to interpret their experience. And then, of course, we love our Bible stories. Stories are very biblical, and the Bible would be nowhere without stories, hey. So stories are really important to us in our immediate experience now in terms of our interpreting our lives and understanding our lives in contemporary times. I think we think that stories have truth in them. They're not always true on the literal level, but I think that we learn true things from stories, and we think we're telling true things when we tell stories. Although it's interesting because sometimes, when I was a kid at least, when you were accused of telling a story, it meant you were telling a lie.
Right.
So there's sort of two ways that that can play. But stories do teach, and they explain things. They present paradigms to us so that we can learn from the prodigal son's story about children who are obnoxious teenagers and run away from home and disobey us, and then they come back, and we understand our love for them to be much more profound, and our family works in a different way. And, you know, stories like the prodigal son have much to teach us today. They demonstrate things and they're proof for things, and my evidence for that is every single session that ever goes on at Holden Village, because whenever someone makes a point about anything at Holden Village, other people leap in with story. They tell stories to back up and support or to contest a point, to say, I have a different take on that issue. I'm going to tell a story that supports an opposite point of view or a different one. So we use them as evidence. I think, for me at least, stories give me a sense of control about my life, particularly in the areas of my life that trouble me. When I'm upset by something I've done, which is fairly frequent, I have to say, I haven't got it right yet, I haven't figured out how to do this, I fret about things. I take them home and I lose sleep and I have anxiety in the pit of my stomach. And what I need to do then, very often, is tell the story of whatever it is, probably to my husband, who adores me. You know, I'm lucky, I guess, but I mean, a lot of your husband, spouses, partners adore you too, and you know what that feeling is like. Or I do it to my women's group, and my women's group is the same way. You know, we've been together for 20 years, there are six of us. We adore each other and understand each other. And the key there is telling the story to someone who loves you. Because when you tell the story to someone who thinks you're just dandy, then you, your side, your reasons for behaving the way you did are understood in a light that makes it reasonable and makes it understandable. And so you feel better because somebody gets it about why you did what you did. They realize that you weren't being an evil or wicked person, but that you had reasons for whatever happened. And you then can package it up. You can say, the knot in your stomach can begin to dissolve and relax, and you can get your sleep again because you have come to accept whatever it was by putting the ending on it, by putting some punctuation in there and putting it all in the light of this loved person. So I think story is a very powerful tool for healing and for just for life, for getting along. I also think that it's a powerful tool in the other way, fallen into the wrong hands. You know, that if you tell your story, when you're trying to explain, when you were a kid in school and you were trying to explain, you know, the dog ate my paper, to a teacher who is not inclined to believe you, or, you know, when you were in trouble with a boss or something, and you find your words just sort of trailing off and not being effective and not filling up the space that they should, and your story dribbles away, it's because this person is looks on you with disdain or with suspicion or with something like that, and you can't even get the story out. You can't even be understood. So it's terribly important for us to listen to each other, to listen to each other with care, with love, with respect, with a sort of willing suspension of disbelief that says, this person's story counts. This is a good person who's telling me the story, and I'm going to listen attentively. I was in a classroom just a couple weeks ago. I do observations for a foundation in Chicago of small grants in grammar school classrooms with very poor children in an extremely poor neighborhood. And the kids were just terrific, and the teacher was fabulous. And when a child would start to tell a story about anything and the child would get interrupted, they would allow the interruption to happen. They'd worked it out in the classroom, and then somebody would say, could John finish his story? And they would go back to it and finish the story. And they did that about 3 times in the hour I was there. I was just stunned. But they clearly understood the power of story. And the classroom with all these extremely poor children was an orderly, joyful, creative, positive place to be. And it was a place where story was at the center. It was just stunning. I'm still processing it. I'm trying to think of the importance of that. But see, I've just told you the story of that day. And it brought tears to my eyes. It was wonderful. So I think story is a terribly important thing in our lives. And I really, really like to facilitate the process and for all of us and have us take it seriously. Stories, we tell stories about all sorts of things, but they teach, when we're really consciously thinking about stories, you might as well tell stories about important things in your life. You might as well go for the big stuff. Tell the birth stories, the death stories, the rites of passage, the ways where you've been, you know, people say push the envelope, you know, where you've sort of grown or where something terribly important has happened in your life and somehow you've resolved it and you can tell the story of that. Let me say a few things about what stories are made out of. It's all obvious stuff, I think, but stories have a voice. Sometimes the voice is a person, a narrator who is omniscient, who knows everything about everybody, who completely understands all the characters and all the motivations and all the secrets. Sometimes, more often, the story is a particular person who only knows what that particular person knows, which would be, for example, if you would tell a story about yourself. You don't understand everybody else's motivation or behavior, but you understand your own to some degree. And you don't even always understand your own completely, which is sometimes what makes a story interesting, because you find out things about yourself. So the voice can change. It can be several different people. It doesn't matter what voice you choose. You should choose, when you're telling stories, choose the voice that comes naturally for that set of stories. Stories have tone. especially if you write stories, you can really control the tone. But I think also, I mean, when you clatter down the back stairs to your neighbors after you've had a robber in the night, your neighbor is going to know from the first five words out of your mouth that there's something wrong. Or when you pick up the phone and you hear in the tone of somebody's voice, the first words they use, even if they say, hi, how are you, you might respond, what's wrong? And tone, I mean, remember those of you who are old enough like me, you remember the shadow on the radio. Who knows what evil lurks? The shadow knows, you know. So there can be sort of a tone to stories, or very light tone. I was thinking today of the. I thought of maybe 20 opening lines to a story about a wedding, and I thought it might be fun for us to brainstorm them for a minute, and say what are some different kinds of weddings that you could imagine the first line of. For example, a wedding that was superficial and frivolous, and you knew the wedding wasn't going to last, and, you know, how would you start a story like that? What would be an opening line? Can you think of one? You could say something like, we all dressed up the same as if we were going to the mall, or, you know, or...
Well, it was a good party.
It was a good party. As we were driving home, my husband said, well, at least it was a good party. How about a wedding that was, if you were going to write a story, say, about an arranged marriage, what could be an opening line there? Can you think of any... I would say the language would be kind of formal and stilted and dry and, you know, something about the train arrived at the appointed hour, or the bride came in the appropriate garb, or, I mean, some kind of very, you know, non-effusive, measured kind of an opening. Whereas, how would you introduce, think of some lines to introduce today's wedding? The story of today.
I will never forget the day the birds flew over the ark.
Yeah. Birds in the bubbles.
Birds in the bubbles over the ark.
Mixed over the ark. Or as I was coming down the hill, or as I was coming up the hill, you know, or the morning was spent in the costume shop.
Have you ever witnessed that?
I love that hat. That was a wonderful hat.
So it would be some kind of, you could get into the story there with some kind of a whimsical opening line. Or you could say, never has a couple been more blessed. You know, when I had Jeff, I just thank you for that laying on of hands at the end. It was so stunning. It was just, I felt, I don't know Teresa and Chuck very well. I've known them this week. But when I felt that laying on of hands, and I was back 10 layers or so, I felt committed to that marriage. I felt connected to it and committed to it. And I thought it was an extremely moving thing for us as a community of people to do. And so, you know, maybe you would start the story of today's marriage with something about your own response. I've never felt so committed to a marriage before. You know, or you could say, you could get into it any number of ways, but then you would go out and tell that story. So opening lines are kind of fun to play with. I mean, I went through here, Women in Fiction 2, which is one of my favorite fiction books, and look just at random. I folded down the corner of the page at four different stories, literally the first four whose opening page I found. This one, M.F.K. Fisher, who was born in 1908. There was some doubt in the woman's mind about whether it would be wise to make notes on her experience at once, or let the long blizzard go through a fifth noisy night. And here's another one. Jane Bowles. Beryl knocked on Harriet's cabin door and was given permission to enter. She found her friend seated near the window, an open letter in her hand. you know, when the letter comes, that's a good, you've got a story to tell there. Muriel Spark, the first year of my life. I was born on the first day of the second month of the last year of the First World War, a Friday. There we've set a frame. Let's see, where's the fourth page I folded down? Here, Sigrid Unset. The Farmers Guild of Acre had St. Margaret for their patroness, and they began their festival each year on the 20th of July, the day of St. Margaret's Mass. So we're going to hear something about that festival. So there are lots of ways to get into a story, and each of them does give something about the tone. It sort of sets a tone. I mean, St. Margaret's Mass, I don't have a sense of evil lurking there. I mean, it'll be interesting, it'll be complex in some way, it'll be about that community. And that brings me to another element that stories have. They have settings, and settings are made out of many things. They're made out of a place. It can be in the country, in the city, it can be, say, in a house, it could be in the middle of a forest fire. I mean, this could be the story of a man who was depressed and was a firefighter and decided to kill himself while he was fighting a fire. You know, or it could be the story of a sort of heroic overcoming of a forest fire. But in any case, that would be about fire. And we would learn lots of details about how fires are fought and that sort of thing. Also in setting is culture, you know, and that includes language. I mean, it includes various linguistic things about differently educated people, differently raised people. Details about behavior, details about value, about religion, about commonplaces, underlying assumptions. I read a story once where one of the commonplaces was, quote, exposing a baby. You know, it was in a different country, it was in a different culture. The underlying assumption in that culture was that if you got a kind of a baby that you couldn't sustain or didn't want, you would put it out on an anthill and it would die. And the story was the conflict of the mother, you know, who found herself in rebellion against her culture. So there's a lot of cultural stuff. And we, as middle-class Christian white people, those of us who fit that description in this room, tend to think of our culture as being the culture and everybody else's culture as being in contrast to it. Like, we're the background in the picture, we're the blue, and everybody else is the sort of odd pieces and colors and furniture and trees in the picture. But in fact, we have culture too. We have particulars. We, white folks, North American, middle class, educated white folks, have oddities about our culture that other people look at and think, that's definitely cultural. That's not the way my world is. We ran into that at Holden Village when we used to do something up here called Rainbow on the Mountaintop, where we would have lots of African American people here for a week or two. And they would, when it came time to clear the table at the end, some of the older African American women who came from a parish in Detroit, and they came on a bus the whole way, said, this is my one vacation of my second half of my life, and I'm not going to clean the table. You know, and, you know, it might be your culture to get up in those Birkenstocks and be leaping around and all joining in and cleaning the table and stuff, but I'm not going to do it. I've come here as your guest, and I expect to be cared for. And, you know, and people in my culture had to go, whoa, wait a minute, they're not acting like me. Well, so there's culture there. That we, you know, it was a great gift to Holden Village those weeks. They were wonderful. Time. So one thing that I do sometimes when I'm really troubled by something and I'm writing in my journal and telling stories to work something out in my head is I just put the whole story a century ago. I write about the same people. I put myself in the story, but if I want to somehow cut myself loose from the immediacy of it and kind of play with the characters and work it out a little bit, I make it in a different time. And it helps me. But you can play with time. You're not required to be literal. You're not required to keep everything just as it was. You can play with stuff. And in fact, sometimes the stories improve for that, and it often helps you understand things better through that. So that brings me to another point in setting, and that is the reality plane. I mean, those of you who read science fiction know what I'm talking about. Setting includes how much literal level reality does the reader expect from you. I have a friend who just sent me a novel she wrote, and in the novel there are two, it's a very literal level novel, except there are two places where she allows magic. And it's spectacular, because just at those two moments, you get a slip off the literal level, and it takes your breath away. And it's so effective in the story. And somebody in a session yesterday or the day before did that. What was the story he told? Oh, he told the story of his child who was born and cried and cried and cried. Remember that? I see heads nodding. And the day of the baptism, the preacher said, "This child will not cry after it's baptized." And in the first 3 weeks of its life, it cried all night long, every night. And from the moment it was baptized, it stopped that. And it didn't cry all night long again. And so there was that moment in the room when it shivers went up our backs. I mean, it was a magic moment almost. And so he told us that story, and it was very effective. I won't forget it. I mean, eventually I will, because my memory is terrible, but for now. So those are interesting things to play with within setting. Then stories obviously can really vary in the sort of size of them. You can tell the story of the man in the session yesterday telling that story, and that's a perfectly good story in itself. And that's a pretty small little, that was about 3 minutes in a session at Holden Village. Or you can tell a story that goes through four generations. You know, if you have Jane Smiley's 1,000 Acres about Iowa farming goes through 2.5 generations at least. There are a lot of wonderful stories that really do take us through lots of time. And those are wonderful stories too. So you can decide, you know, I mean, any story is legitimate, any story. A tiny moment on the L, my student will come and tell me a tiny moment that happened in downtown Chicago with somebody on the train, and it'll be transformational. The student will never be the same. That moment, meeting someone's eyes and sort of getting the gift of some self-respect and respect for each other and graciousness, the student will view human beings differently forevermore. So all of those things are parts of stories. And one of the nice things about stories is there's no rules, and they're so different from one another. And so all of our stories are honored and good. Some things that I learned about myself when I'm telling stories, what I'm drawn to talk about tells me something about who I am and what I'm working on in my head, what I'm thinking about. What details I include tell me things about myself. Little tiny details are very important in stories. And the details you're leaving out, invariably, you're leaving out 1,000, 2,000 details. But the ones you choose to include, the four details or whatever that you include, are very important. They tell a lot about who you are, what's important to you, what are you thinking about, what are you dealing with. And they tell the listener a lot. They communicate things. You know, when you describe a hand reaching for something and say that it trembled, it makes a very big difference than if it grabbed. I said yesterday, and I think it's important to say again, when my voice falters, when I find I've run out of words, when I find I can't tell that part of the story, that's very important. That's a place where I need to work. That's a place where I feel bad, I feel unresolved, I don't understand it, I need to work more on it. You need to ask me questions about it, is my friend, to help me deal with it. So when your voice falters, when you come to a place where you don't want to talk, that's important to you. That's a gift to you that you can learn from.
Why is it a gift?
Because then you learn more about what you don't know. And sometimes we keep that so well hidden from ourselves. We don't want to know what we don't know. There are things we don't want to look at. But then if we recognize that warning flag sticking up, whoops, this is something I cannot talk about, I must be troubled in that area. I mean, maybe it's easier for you, but for me it's so hard to know what I'm troubled by even, or what I don't know, what I can't talk about. I keep myself so buried and packaged that I value little clues from my subconscious that tell me, pay attention. And then the last thing that I would say is important to me is I really think it matters a lot that I tell the same story differently to different people. And so what do you learn about yourself depending on who you can tell the story to? If you tell it to someone who looks, who you know loves you and is interested in you, your story comes out differently than if you tell it to someone who thinks of you in a different way. So all of those things about story are important and interesting, I think. I'd like us to spend 5 minutes working on making yourself just a few notes or an outline, and then I want us to tell some stories. So, and nobody's required to. Nobody has to say a word about the story that you're thinking of. But yesterday we wrote the stories. Today I'm suggesting that we just sort of outline them and figure out what we want to say. Stories have three parts. They have beginnings. And the beginning, we've talked some about how to get into a story. And you can get into it any way, any which way. You don't have to say, in the beginning, or once upon a time, or I once knew a woman who, or and it came to pass in those days. It doesn't have to be a sort of ritualistic beginning. It can be, I was bemused to walk up the hill and see bubbles floating over the trees, you know. I mean, it can be some small thing. Or it can be in the beginning or once upon a time. Middles of stories tend to do better if they have precise small details in them. They tend to do better if you try not to tell the meaning of it to the listener. You don't want to sort of force them to get it. They tend to do better if they're concrete, specific, detailed, tell little tiny images, tell little tiny descriptions.
My nephew, who's an English major and visited me this spring, said that the bywords in his short stories course was show, don't tell.
Yeah.
And show that really was helpful. Yeah. Just have the three words, show, don't tell.
Uh-huh. Don't tell me the meaning of your story. Let me figure that out. But you tell me what happened. So be concrete as you can. And then the end of the story, I would say that it's almost, ending stories is intuitive. People know when they're done telling their story. And if you don't, I mean, you all know someone that you sometimes say, this person never puts a period at the end of her, you know, talking. Or she always... she's hard to break into because she always dribbles on. She doesn't take a breath. So there are a few people who don't have this instinct, but I would say most people have an instinct to know when their story's done. You don't have to say something grand like, my story is done. Or you don't have to say a moral. Although sometimes just naturally, quite often naturally, at the end of a story, some kind of a summing up statement comes out. And that's good. That's fine. But you're not required to do that. You have to tell the story of what happened. Does the story you tell us answer the question, what happened? I think those are things that that's the question that you might want an answer to. Okay, so let's spend some time getting organized in our own thoughts, and then let's try telling some stories. You might as well tell a story that's important to you, although you don't have to. I like tales that must be told. You know, the Ancient Mariner has this tale that he has to get out every so often, and I think those stories are important. So I would say that we'll just take maybe 5 minutes. Tea Ministry will take 5 minutes of silence, and then we'll begin to tell each other some stories. I'm hoping people are making more outline sort of notes than... Although sometimes when you start writing it, you find you just want to write it. That ancient impulse to write things down takes over. So I think journaling at Holden Village is a wonderful thing to do, and I recommend if you are finding that you're liking doing this writing, that you should go to the bookstore and buy yourself a journal and write in it. Write about things you know about. Write about your childhood and your home and your family. and then Way will lead on to Way. Well, who's got a story they can tell us?
I'll start before I forget.
Yeah.
I need my
That's fine.
It's probably...
Let me just frame this up a little bit. When we do this, we don't do critical feedback. We don't sort of criticize each other's writings, but it's fine to give the kind of feedback that says what I got from that was, or I found this really interesting, or I thought it was beautiful the way you wrote, or that sort of feedback. So we will have a little chance for feedback with people, but we will not use this to sort of be writing teachers to each other, or storytelling teachers, in the critical sense. All right, go ahead.
It probably was not a smart idea to begin a vacation with four people stuffed into a blue Volkswagen, but we were headed on a skiing trip with our family several years ago to Sun Valley, Idaho, from Los Angeles. My husband Rich was driving, and as on all of our car trips, especially in this old car, we continually wondered when the first car trouble would begin and what it would be. Our two boys, Scott and Randy, were stuffed into the backseat of the Volkswagen along with assorted articles of clothing which didn't fit in a suitcase and had been stuffed anywhere there was room in the car. The second day out, our route took us across the isolated back roads of California and Idaho, east of the Sierra Nevada mountains. And on this day, for hour after hour, we did not see a car, another person, or even pass a gas station. Nearing evening, the boys and my husband and I got hungry, and we noticed up ahead that we were coming to a town. It happened to be Boise, Idaho, and we were on the outskirts. The first chance we thought we saw a building, we pulled off, and there happened to be a speed bump because we were by a state park. Actually, it was a fairground. We went over the speed bump, and all of a sudden my husband said, "I have no control over this car. I have nothing, no power, nothing." He said, "Scott, get out and see if you see anything." Our son got out of the car, went behind, and he came back and said, "Dad, the motor is lying on the blacktop." And what had happened, we had had our car serviced before we took off, and a Volkswagen is a simple car. The technicians had put the motor in. There are four bolts to attach it to the frame. They had not screwed in the bolts. There were no bolts. They had set it in the frame. We were 10 feet from a telephone booth and a mile from a gas station.
What a great story. Yes, that's a wonderful story. Oh. Thank you. Anybody want to say anything before we move on to the next person?
That's a good story.
Yeah.
And it's true.
Yeah. And there you have a little sense of the grace of God. Okay, thanks. Who's next?
I'll do another driving story.
Okay,
Anne. That's in my joint story. We decided together.
Okay, Anne and Beth have a story to tell.
3 years ago, Beth and I went to Africa together. We went to Namibia. And one of the most exciting days was the day we went to Etosha Game Park. We traveled across, the way you travel in Etosha Game Park is you travel from one side to the other and see things along the way, but you have to be sure to reach the gate by sunset because they close the gate. And if you aren't there, you are in the game park for the night. And we had a wonderful day. We saw giraffes, which was the most important thing because it looked like dinosaur heads over sparse trees. We stopped at water holes that looked like the Garden of Eden. They had giraffes and zebras and water birds and springbok all standing there together in peace. And we had a wonderful day just taking our time. And the afternoon was moving on. And as we left one of these water holes, we knew that we had to keep on the road and just keep going in order to reach that gate by the time the sun dropped below the horizon. And as we were about a mile out of this water hole, a Volkswagen van pulled up beside us and pointed down at one of our tires. And we were a group of about eight, so we were pretty noisy. And when that happened, we started listening and you could hear something flap in the stuff.
Oh.
And so it was a flat tire. And so we all tumbled out of the van in order to make it possible to get a change. And the safari guide who had noticed us pulling out and noticed that I was tired down was helping us quickly get the tire changed, but in the background we could hear elephants trumpeting and we could see the sun going down on the horizon. Our helper waved us off and promised that he'd call ahead or go back and call ahead and let them know we were coming, but we had about an hour that we raced toward that gate wondering what really happened when if that gate closed and the sun dropped below the horizon and it started getting darker and we got to the gate and they were waiting for us.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Exciting day.
Wow.
Yeah,
you can see the eyes are just shining. You did that very well.
That was suspenseful.
Yeah, suspense is a good element to put into stories. You know, not all stories have it, but it's fun. That was good. Thank you. Thanks, Beth.
Okay.
Okay, who's got a story?
Well, I sort of have another vehicle story. And I've probably told, I don't know, I've told this story many times since it happened a week ago Monday night. My son and his friend, my youngest son Daniel and his friend Austin and I left the house to go to a meeting at church. And we got less than a mile away from home. I was driving a big brown van. I'm not even sure what year or make it what it is because I can't remember. I don't remember makes of cars very, very well. But we were on a dirt road, and on this dirt road called Pond Road, there's a swamp on both sides of the road. And I noticed ahead of us, jogging in toward our vehicle, was our neighbor, Dick. And right where the swamp is on both sides of the road, there are bumps in the road. And I remember thinking to myself, well, I should probably slow down a little bit and give Dick a little bit more room and try and miss some of those bumps in the road. And so I started to pull over to the side of the road and my wheel caught into the soft dirt on the side, and before I knew it, it had literally pulled us over into the swamp, and so the van tipped over sideways about 3 to 4 feet down into the swamp, and I didn't have my seatbelt on, and somehow I remember flipping out of my seat and landing on my feet somehow behind the seat next to me. And I remember it was almost dreamlike. I was seeing dust flying through the air and things flying through the air. And the boys were fine, and my son Daniel was screaming. Well, he started screaming, "Get us out of here." And the water started coming up in the van. And none of us knew, of course, how deep the swamp was, and I started to panic in a way that I have never in my life panicked before. And the door, all the windows and the one sliding door was down in the water, and there was one door up above me, and I couldn't even budge that door. And I kept thinking to myself, well, Dick's coming. And it was real dark in there because there were no windows on one side of the van and the others were down in the water, and there were no windows on the back, and so the only window was up front, but that was kind of darkened by the water and the grass and stuff, so I couldn't see very well. But I did catch a glimpse of his face as he was coming in front of the van, and it was like seeing a reflection of my own horror. I'm sure Dick didn't know what he was going to find, although he heard Daniel screaming. But he scared me. I looked at him and I felt more fear than before I had seen him. And he couldn't reach the door up above us because he was sinking in the swamp and he was afraid the van would turn over further on top of him. And all I kept thinking was we were gonna drown in this van. And here Dick was, and he should be able to get us out, but he wasn't getting us out. And the next thing I know, Daniel screaming help, get us out of here, and his friend Austin is yelling at him to shut up. And I'm just frantically looking for a way out. And then finally we ran to the back door and was pounding on that looking for a handle, and I never could find the handle on the door. And Daniel calmed down enough to, and Dick couldn't find it on the outside of the door. I think he was panicked as well, and so he wasn't seeing, I wasn't seeing any kind of door. And finally Daniel was able to pound on the door right where the handle was. He couldn't talk hardly because he was panicked as well, but he was able to hit where it was, and Dick opened the door. And I felt like I was a caged animal. I felt like I was getting out of something. I can't even describe the feeling I had because I've never had that before. But all week long, even here this week, when I think about baptism and the power of water, it's the first time I think I've felt the power of the life of water, but also the power of death. I mean, it was like, geez, that's the worst thing I can imagine, is drowning in water, or seeing my kids drown in water, not being able to save them. It was real frightening. And so this week, I think I felt real vulnerable. And when they've gone up on the mountains, it's like, oh, I can't hardly stand it when they go next to the ledge, because of that vulnerability, you know, and the fragileness of life, and how fast and quick that happened. It was, I'm just being in touch with that all week.
Wow, that's a very powerful story.
I'll change the tone of this a little bit, but
I just want to say one more thing about her story before we move on. Did you notice that, I mean, the millions of details, little concrete specific details, that I was in that van with you. And then somehow when she made it the moral of the story, the fragileness of life, the fear that she's feeling this week when the kids go in the mountains, and the relationship with baptism this week, somehow that fit as the capstone on it. It felt like such an appropriate place to bring that. So we needed to be brought somewhere than just the door opening. And you brought us there. So it was a really good way to end it. So now we'll all really see you differently for the rest of the week because you're struggling with this. But thank you for sharing that.
And you can tell it again if you want to.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
I was going to change the pace just a little bit. An unlikely chance meeting can have an impact on an entire life and career. I was attending a routine business meeting with strangers and sat down next to someone that I didn't know, and we engaged in some small talk. The meeting lasted a half hour or so. And later, that man, who unbeknownst to me, was searching for a certain type of candidate for a position with him, followed up on my brief conversation with him, and it affected my whole life. He became my mentor, probably the man who taught me more than any other person, and yet it all started from that base. And most of us think that establishing a career is an intelligent choice. It can also be a sheer chance and no logic or sense to what happens, and yet it had a tremendous effect on me in my whole lifetime.
Isn't that interesting? Huh. Well, and now, you could have made a different ending on that. You could have said, because I was a clever and responsible person, and he immediately saw how wonderful I was. So if you do your homework and dot every I, cross every T, but no, you're much more humble. And so you said, it's all just chance. Mm-hmm. And it changed my life. Mm-hmm. Well, that was a wonderful story. Thank you. Okay.
I just happened to think of something that was, you might call it chance. I was in Seattle, but didn't want to work there. This was in my 20s. I didn't want to stay there. In between, I just didn't know. In fact, I had a nervous breakdown, and I just wasn't ready for a permanent job. But so I went to a lot of employment agencies looking for work, especially temporary work. And at each employment agency,
I had to fill out an application, and I noticed, you know, I'm always kind of looking around offices because I like office work, and I've always noticed what kind of filing system they get for their cards or so on. And at that time, it was very difficult to get any kind of work, but I did get several temporary jobs. And with the first one I got, I had a phone call from a men's clothing store, and he said, can you come to work with us because somebody is sick? And I said, I'd lost all confidence in myself because I had been at all these places and hadn't found work. So I said, well, what kind of work? And, well, he was not quite sure. So I said, typing? He said, I think so. So I knew I had typed a lot, so I thought, well, if I did it before, I can do it again. So I went down there, and I was supposed to balance receipts from all the different departments. It was a huge men's clothing store, and balance them, you know, up and down and across so that they would match. Well, to begin with, he said, I'll put this figure, you know, from this receipt into the adding machine. So I punched the right buttons, you know, for these various numbers, and he said, now total it. And I said, I don't know where the total button is. And he said, I don't either. So I suppose there was one that said total. I pushed it, and it was right. By the end of the day, he asked me if I'd like to work there permanently. Well, I worked there about one more day, but I didn't want to be doing that all my life. And I worked in several different places, and they always asked me if I'd like to stay permanently, but I wasn't ready to do that. So then I had a call from Dr. J.C. K. Price of the education office in Minneapolis, our church headquarters, where I worked 2 years previously in between my college years. And he wanted me to come, and half of my job was to be to set up a parish workers' placement service. And so I had been in all these different placement offices, and I had experienced, you know, not having a job, you know, and different feelings that you have when you can't find something. So you just can't say these things are just by chance, you know. I agree with you, it seems that way, but I think God was preparing me for this new job.
What a nice story. And you know what I think set it up really well is saying, I had a nervous breakdown. And so that you were saying, I was broken down as far as I could go. And I had these experiences that built me up so that I had the confidence and the knowledge to do a really good job. So that was a lovely story, and it was well designed. It just flowed naturally. Thank you. Who else has a story? Okay.
I have a story about my dog. And I think immediately came to mind when we were, well, I don't know, we should think about a story. So I think God works for me, or I understand God a lot through nature and animals. And last fall, I was in my cabin doing homework. I have a little cocker spaniel, one of my dogs, and I heard this high-pitched, fast bark, which I know is his call that he's after some kind of animal. So I ran outside, and he was underneath the cabin, and it was snowing out, windy, cold, and I knew that he was after something. I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was something. And all I could, the way I could follow him around the cabin was I could hear his head thumping on the bottom of the cabin. So I was running around calling for him, and he wasn't coming out. And I'm thinking it's either a skunk or a porcupine or something or other. And basically, I just had to stand there because I called him, and he was frantically into whatever he was chasing. And I stood out there for about 10 minutes, and finally he came out the back end of the cabin after a porcupine. Porcupine went up the tree, but just before it got to the tree, my dog grabbed a hold of it twice. And I ran and grabbed my dog, and he was just going nuts. He's small, he probably weighs 20 pounds, but I had all I could do to hold on to him. That's how frantic he was. And I just wrapped him in my arms, and I ran into the cabin, and then I started looking at him, and he had quills everywhere. I mean, his face was full of them, his throat was full of them, his chest was full of them. And I couldn't set him down because he was just going nuts, and I thought he was going to hyperventilate. He's an older dog, and I wasn't sure if he was going to have a heart attack or what. So I'm holding him. I'm trying to dial the phone to call the veterinary clinic, which was closed. It was after hours. And I ended up having to leave a message, and they were supposed to get back to me within 15 minutes, and it was long 15 minutes. So in the meantime, I started pulling these quills out of my dog, and that was going, it was going okay. But I thought, I got out as many clothes as I could get out. The vet did call me back, told me to bring him into town, and I wasn't sure if I could drag him in by myself because he was just going crazy. So I got most of the clothes out from around his mouth. Well, he had clothes that had stapled his tongue to the bottom of his mouth, and so he was choking. It was causing a reaction to him where he was really having a tough time. I'm bawling because I absolutely, my dogs and my kids, and I was trying to maintain some motherhood here. And it was really difficult. But I did. I ended up getting him into town, and it was almost like, you know, I got out as many clothes as I could. I put him across my lap, and I was just holding him real tight to me. And it was almost as if at one point he understood that I was helping him. And I don't, some people think it's really weird, but I think animals perceive more than what we give them credit for. So I got him to the vet. We gave him anesthetic, and he let me pull the quilts out. He also let me clean his teeth as long as he was out. So I did that, saved me about $60. And I was bringing him home, and he was completely knocked out. And the only way that I could tell that he was alive is he was drooling all over my lap. And, which was comfort to me, but I was like 2 miles from my home, and he kind of started whining and, you know, coming around real groggy, and I was talking to him. And I got into my cabin. And I put a big pillow on the floor and my jacket around him, and I was sitting there petting him and talking to him. And the more he came to, the more he was whining and crying. And I was sitting there at one point, and he started trying to crawl up on my lap. And it was, I mean, he wanted comfort. It was just incredible. I picked him up, I put him on my lap, and I was rocking him in my, this was kind of strange, rocking him in my chair. But as I was doing that, I had this incredible insight as to how God works, I think, sometimes in our own lives. And I thought, you know, I could see that my dog was in danger, or I knew that. I didn't know exactly what was going on under the cabin. And sometimes I think, you know, I run around doing things in my life that probably aren't good for me, and perhaps God is calling in whatever way God is calling me, but I'm so busy doing whatever I'm doing that I'm not listening. I'm not paying attention. And I really got this incredible feeling of how God kind of works in my life. And a lot of times I don't listen to God. And God knows probably what's best for me. I would have not left my dog. I could have chose, I suppose, to leave my dog outside and say, well, you got to throw the porcupine, deal with it. I would never do that because I love him. And so it was kind of like a insight as to how God works, because God loves me, and the different ways that God takes care of me. And also this real feeling of, in my being able to comfort my dog, and I probably don't love humans as much as I do animals, but I've learned so much through animals. So I just think it was real powerful for me, and I learned an awful lot about God's something through his creation. So
thank you. Very nice story, and I love the details. I love the head hitting the and the specifics about the quills stapling the tongue to the mouth, and the, all of those details made it so real to us. And then what it meant to you was so important, and that was a nice way to end the story. So that worked really well, and it was a vivid story. I feel very as though I can picture it. I want to know more about your life now. I want to know some other chapters. What time did we begin? We began just about
6:15.
So it's 7:15 now. Does that mean we're supposed to end?
Yeah.
Do we have time for one more story, do you think? Do you want to hear another one more?
I don't have a story, but I have a reflection about how storytelling helps build community and warms up the room.
Mm-hmm. Maria, tell us your story about
that. I don't have a story, but I'm sensing a warmth that when I came, it wasn't. And I feel closer to the people now that I tell stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So stories work. It's worked.
Mm-hmm. It's a vehicle for community.
Yeah, it's a vehicle for community. That's a wonderful way to end the session. Mm-hmm. It's very important. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely true about stories. And it changes, even if someone sits next to you on the bus and tells you a story, even you feel, mm-hmm. you get a window into their lives. And So on the note of stories being a vehicle for building community, I thank you very much for coming and sharing your stories.
Thank you.
Thank you.